in the 1960s, the CIA, using them as sort of the real planning group, had within their group a program they called the ZR rifle program. That was the cryptonym for their assassination apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Out of this ZR rifle program, the cryptonym for its principal agent was QJ Wynn.
QJ Wynn?
QJ Wynn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, of course, this ZR rifle program began to be used with respect to Cuba in 1961. And in doing so, that's when they first became involved with organized crime. This QJ Wynn plays an important role in the release on very shortly after the assassination of a man by the name of Tom Davis.
Released? What do you mean?
Released from custody of the police over in Algeria.
Oh.
He was arrested in gun running activities. He was released on the behest or with the help of QJ Wynn. What makes this intriguing is that Tom Davis told a well-respected reporter in Dallas that he was using the name of Oswald and in his gun-running activities to the Cuban exiles, that he was connected to the Cuban exiles, but that he was running these guns with a man by the name of Jack Ruby, who was the killer of Lee Harvey Oswald, which, as we now know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Jack Ruby connects to organized crime directly. What Mr. Meritz did best, among other things, was smuggle heroin into the United States. He was a killer. He became a member of the French Secret Service, and that's the equivalent of our CIA, STEC.
Mm-hmm.
And in his connections with that organization, began a drug operation into this country. He, in my opinion, is a good suspect for the director of the assassination, and could possibly be QJ Wynn, who was a European.
The second in our two-part series on an update on the Kennedy assassination with the author of Cover Up. We'll provide recent information uncovered by the Freedom of Information Act, by interviews with various people and congressional sources, right now.
We're back again with Gary Shaw, author of Cover Up, an architect in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Cover Up is one of those books, an incredible book, which tells the truth about the Kennedy assassination. Our last program, we went into great detail to show that it was impossible for one person, Lee Harvey Oswald or anybody, to have killed John F. Kennedy because there were more than one shot fired. Well, on our program this week, we're going to do some speculation about what this means for the country. We're going to talk about some of the new evidence that has come up since the last program we did with Gary back in 1979, and some surprise connections with us, too. What has happened since 79? There have been congressional investigations, and your investigations have been going on. What are some of the highlights?
Well, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, of course, came out with their conclusion that there was a probable conspiracy, which was a real winner. for us. We had fought long and hard for that and had actually assisted that committee in every way that we could to see that they reached that conclusion. Unfortunately, they didn't go far enough. They did say that the Justice Department should pursue several areas, which they have not done even to this date. The chief counsel for that committee said that it was a historical fact as far as he was concerned. The mob killed John Kennedy. Now, I don't know as I totally agree. I agree that the mob was heavily involved and probably paid a big portion of the money and used their personnel to do it. But there were others, I think, involved in it.
They didn't say anything about the FBI or the CIA.
They said that the Warren Commission as a whole and the investigative bodies that was used by the Warren Commission all was flawed. So there was a real put down by this new committee of the original Warren Commission and its report and its findings and conclusions. And so that was important to us. If we're going to get the truth out to the American people, that was a big step or a big hurdle. Unfortunately, the major news media said ho-hum to it, and therefore the majority of the American people don't even know that, even though they still believe today that at least about 85 to 90% of the American people believe that Oswald did not act alone. They've never been given any evidence on primetime national television to show them why they believe that, and there's plenty, as you've seen last week, and we'll talk about this week.
Yeah. Gary, let's start off with this concept of the cover-up. This was the title of your book. Who did the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination and why? You've indicated that the Warren Commission report was part of this, but who would want to cover up the truth about the Kennedy assassination?
Boy, I asked that question many times, because when you start asking that, you start looking at men like Earl Warren and Alan Dulles and Gerald Ford and J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Helms, who was director of the Central Intelligence Agency at that time. And you just go on and on, and it's mind-boggling to know that, hey, there was something amiss here, that there was a cover-up, and did these men do it? And I don't even try to answer that question any longer. All I can say, mm-hmm. without a shadow of a doubt, is that there was a cover-up, and we can point to it specifically and particular instances that changed the real meaning of the president's death. And I'm not going to sit here and say President Johnson did it and caused it to be done. I don't think we can do that. I think you've got to come back around and find out who did it. You know, get somebody who we know covered up or altered testimony and say, why did you alter this testimony? Why did you do this? Who told you to do it? Who was your superior that caused this to happen? And then go right on up the ladder. And I think eventually we'd get to the truth.
The incredible part about it to me is not only these various government agencies were involved in the cover-up, but also the regular mass media, Life magazine, the networks, and even as late as, when was that Dan Rather cover-up thing about 10 years ago?
About 10 years ago, uh-huh.
Where they came out and they looked at all the evidence, we're going to make sure we do everything right, and they came to the conclusion that Oswald was the lone assassin. And now recently, when Walter Cronkite was wanting to do a complete investigation and documentary on the Kennedy assassination, CBS turned him down. Uh-huh. Even Uncle Walter.
Well, you remember that Uncle Walter was the one that was interviewing Lyndon Johnson when Lyndon Johnson made the comment that we were running a, quote, a damned murder incorporated in the Caribbean in the early 1960s. Do you remember that? And CBS cut that completely out. And it was years before we knew what was cut out. We just knew that something was cut. And so the media did participate in the cover-up. Now, C.D. Jackson is a long time OSS and CIA.
He's head of Time Life.
Yes, he was the head of Time Life at that time.
And a very big person in the total American power structure.
That's right.
He's a big person in the organizations like the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Council of Foreign Relations.
Unfortunately, he died soon after that.
Uh-huh.
He was the one responsible for buying the Zapruder film, printing a few frames of it in Life magazine, and then locking it up because he didn't think the American people ought to see it. I take the opposite view. If the American people had seen that film on Friday night, November the 22nd, 1963, they'd have never bought the Lone Assassin single bullet theory.
Well, let's take a look at that remarkable and revealing film right now.
This is the famous Abraham Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination.
The president is now hit in the back, and then while he's behind the sign, he's hit in the throat from the front. He's now grasping at his throat and trying to talk to his wife, and the fatal headshot. This is a blow-up of that headshot. The president is hit, now he's trying to talk to his wife, and he receives the fatal headshot.
The president's reaction to the headshot can be seen more clearly with these enlargements. Notice that as the president is struck by the fatal headshot, his body is driven violently backwards.
Let's indeed go into some of these theories of who actually did the Kennedy assassination, beginning with your theory at the end of Cover-Up. Your book that was published on the Kennedy assassination, you ran through all the possible suspects and then reached some conclusions as to what might have happened. Do you want to recap that for us, and then we can take off from that?
Okay, what I did in 1976, and I've changed a little since then, and of course I think a person that doesn't change as new evidence comes to light is, you know, you better change. But I looked at three things. Any crime, motive, means, and opportunity. John Kennedy, without a doubt, had managed to alienate every major force in the country, whether it be the right wing or the military or the CIA, organized crime. His brother Bobby was going after organized crime like no one had ever done before. And everybody, it seemed like, or every special interest group, he had managed to alienate. So there were a lot of people, the oil people here in Texas, the extreme right wing here in Texas hated him.
The Cubans, because of the Bay of Pigs fiasco.
Right, because of that. And so he had enemies. So there was a lot of motive to his death. Each one of these groups had the means, you know, and each one of them had the opportunity.
Well, they also said Bobby Kennedy, they were saying that they were thinking about shutting down the CIA because of the bad information that they received and the bad guidance concerning the Bay of Pigs. So that's another connection.
Robert and John both alienated the military leaders because they wanted to go blow Cuba off the face of the earth when the missile crisis was going on. And so they had a lot of enemies, and each one of them had motive, means, and opportunity. You understand? But the big thing that I pointed out in 1976 is not all of those groups had the ability or the power to cover up the true facts surrounding the assassination. And so that's what I tried to look at. And I said in 1976 that to cover up the facts surrounding the assassination was proper suspicion of guilt. And so I pointed a strong finger after examining the motives and the means of all of these groups. I pointed a strong finger, and I think, you know, still could, toward the military-industrial intelligence complex that had evolved and that President Eisenhower had warned about before he left office. And I've changed somewhat since then, just simply because some of the things that we know now has caused me to change. That, to me, would involve too many people. Too many people that I think are honorable people. Not everybody in the CIA is a bad guy. Not everybody in the FBI is bad. Most of them are American citizens good mind and good quality and good moral values and so forth. So I had to look at it as the years went by from another standpoint, because the people kept asking me, boy, that's a huge conspiracy. Somebody's going to crack and talk. So I finally came around to, as we learned about the strange marriage between executive branch and organized crime through a mistress, through assassination apparatus pointed toward Fidel Castro in Cuba that was okayed by the Kennedys. Operated by the CIA and using Cuban exiles because they wanted to get Cuba back for many reasons. Cuba, the organized crime wanted it back because as they're Las Vegas off the coast of Florida, you know, that's a money-making, you know, that was their drug jumping-off place into the United States. And America, the United States, wanted Cuba. They didn't want Reds, you know, right there 90 miles off their coast. And so there was a strange marriage between this CIA personnel who were training the Cuban exiles. And by the way, they trained them well in sabotage, assassination, and smuggling. The Cubans are still using that, yeah, even today, you know. And so you have that marriage that if, and this is purely speculation, but I don't mind speculation if it's good speculation. Let's just take a scenario that they put together an assassination team to go after Castro.
Well, we know they did. This has been well documented.
We know they did, and they failed. Mm-hmm. Our government says that they failed 8 times. Mr. Castro says about 24 times. Probably somewhere in between that's the truth, but probably closer to Mr. Castro's estimate. But if, let's say, they turn these same assassins, or say they turn for whatever reason, more money, because they hated what Mr. Kennedy was doing, if they were Cuban exiles or partially Cuban exiles, they hated it because Kennedy had now turned his back on his promise of a free Cuba. Organized crime had felt betrayed because here they were working together and now suddenly they're not. You don't do the mafia that way. You know, you jump in bed with them and you go along with them and everything's fine, but if you cross them, they'll write you a letter.
And it kind of blows up.
And let's say that the same group ended up shooting the President of the United States in Dallas. In fact, on the day that it happened, Robert Kennedy picked up the phone and called one of the Cuban exiles and said, one of your guys killed the President.
What did he
This was in the Washington Post, and this came out just about probably 5 or 6 years ago. Okay, so here's Bobby Kennedy saying, you know, what I have a tendency to believe happened, that there was some Cuban exiles involved, and they were trained in assassination. Why not use them? And they wanted revenge because their brothers, their friends, their compatriots in the invasion at the Bay of Pigs were slaughtered.
They think Kennedy sabotaged the Bay of Pigs, that the Eisenhower administration had promised these Cuban exiles that the United States would invade Cuba or would at least organize an invasion of Cubans to overthrow Castro.
Right.
And Kennedy was unenthusiastic about it and didn't give them what they consider adequate support. So they were outraged.
And the one thing that he did is that they were promised an umbrella of air support.
Mm-hmm.
You don't invade without that air support. And that's what Kennedy called off right at the last minute and left them vulnerable at the invasion and allowed them to be slaughtered. That was the key word with the Cuban exiles, by the way, and we may talk about this if you want to, and that's this umbrella of air support. Every time they would turn, they would talk about the invasion of the Bay of Pigs. They would talk about, we're going to have an umbrella of air support that will carry us in and make ready for this invasion.
Of course, there were a lot of flaws in the CIA. The CIA estimated that the people would uprise against Castro and there'd be easy pickings, but as we know, this didn't happen.
So they didn't.
Even without the, even if they had had the air umbrella, it'd still been highly questionable whether they'd been
able
to.
Well, the key was, though, mm-hmm. is that if they could make the invasion work mm-hmm. and get into the mountains just like Castro did, mm-hmm. then that's when the people would, they would begin to sway people to come in their directions. And they never got, with that, they were never able to get that little guerrilla group like Castro had. So we don't know whether it would have worked or not.
Right. But they, of course, thought that it
yeah.
would.
Yes.
Well, there was also another very important situation regarding Cuba and Kennedy, and that is, as I understand, that Kennedy was having secret indirect talks through the Swiss embassy or somebody with Castro
French,
to
French
try
embassy.
To French embassy
uh-huh.
to try to normalize relations with Castro, and of uh-huh. course the CIA would have known about this, and so this they would have fed this to their buddies and the,
uh-huh.
Well, there have been some very strange things that have happened that popped up in the past 8 years. Like you were showing me some guy actually confessed to being part of the assassination team.
That's something we could
down in San Antonio.
We could find out right here in Texas. Most of your viewers will be familiar with the Judge John Wood case in San Antonio, a federal judge who was assassinated in 1979, and that a man by the name of Charles Harrelson was arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison for that assassination, and that's what it was. But what most people don't know is that when he was arrested, Mr. Harrelson actually confessed, and this is a March 20th, 1981 Dallas Morning News article. Several officers heard the confession of Charles Harrelson as he confessed to killing President John Kennedy.
And this is in just about two or three sentences buried in the bottom, in the middle of the report.
Right.
And they never even
it never got national coverage of a major.
Never.
So was he involved with organized crime? Did this guy have
yes.
a
Yes, and
history?
Of course, we're always interested. In fact, we were interested in him as soon as he killed John Wood, simply because of his appearance. Mm-hmm. Because actually on the day of the assassination, three men were taken into custody, mm-hmm. hiding over beyond the grassy knoll in a boxcar, open boxcar. They were paraded across Elm Street in front of the school book depository, and about six photographs were taken of them.
These are the famous three tramps.
The famous three tramps, and
yeah.
taken into the sheriff's headquarters. Nothing was ever said about them. There is no record of their arrest.
So we don't
no
know
names.
Who they are. We don't have any pictures.
We've got pictures, but we never knew who they were.
Okay. And the pictures is what.
And the pictures are what are what's fascinating.
Okay.
Because these will be bad photographs, but here. Is a picture of one of the tramps, along with the mugshot of Charles Harrelson. You can see the strong facial resemblance here. Here's another photograph at a different angle of the tallest of the three tramps, and also a different view of a photograph of Charles Harrelson. And we've got that.
Boy, they look so much alike. Yeah, when you see them up.
Here's the third view, the same tramp, the same tall tramp, but a different view of Charles Harrelson. Not only do the photographs look alike, not only has he confessed, but he also was connected to all the right people. He was a friend of the best friend of Jack Ruby, knew Jack Ruby. Was familiar with Dallas and all the organized crime figures in Dallas. He also was involved with gun running during the Bay of Pigs, so he was familiar with Cuban exiles and some of the CIA personnel.
He had all the right connections.
Mm-hmm. And these photographs, as bad as they were shown to some forensic pathologists who study facial features, okay, and testify in courtrooms about whether this photograph, if it's aged 10 years, would look like this photograph. And their findings on three of these photographs were that there was a 90 to 95% probability that Charles Harrelson and this tallest of the three tramps were one and the same.
So this would give credence to his confession.
Very, very much so.
Let's go back for just a minute to this organized crime connection. You pointed out that organized crime was very angry because they lost Cuba. They had big prostitution, gambling, all kinds of drug organizations that were operating in Cuba. After the Cuban Revolution, of course, they were put out of business. So they would be in favor of the overthrow of Castro.
Correct.
And therefore would be angry at the failure of the Bay of Pigs. Plus, Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General, went after organized crime. And they thought they had an understanding with the Kennedys that they would leave the Kennedys alone and cooperate in certain ways if the Kennedys didn't come after them, and Bobby Kennedy came after them. So they would think that they were betrayed, and in terms of their primitive ethic, that therefore they could get revenge.
Well, there's evidence that that organized crime got them the Illinois vote. You know how important the Illinois
stealing
vote.
The election through the Daley machine in Chicago.
That's right. And we also know that Sam Giancana was out of Chicago, and he had a mistress. Some of your viewers probably are familiar with that came out just this year, that a lady by the name of Judith Exner was a mistress of Sam Giancana, head of the Chicago right. Mafia, and also head of this assassination attempts on Fidel Castro, organized by our CIA, and that Jack Kennedy had a relationship with this same Judith Exner, and she confessed recently. Yes, they were lovers.
She was a mistress.
And that she actually became a courier between the President of the United States and Sam Giancana during the period that she was seeing him in and out of the White House.
There's another mistress involved here. I saw in a Liberty Lobby or a Spotlight article a few years ago where there was an investigation or something. Maybe you read about that too, about Marita Lorenz, who had been one of the favorites of Fidel Castro, and she had testified in court that she had participated in a two-car caravan a couple days before the assassination that went to Dallas. This caravan had rifles, had firearms. One of the passengers was Lee Harvey Oswald. And when they got to Dallas, they were paid off by E. Howard Hunt, who also took the arms. Now, is this verifiable, or is it anything you've heard about?
I've heard about it and read about it, and there's no way you can verify something like this except to say that E. Howard Hunt goes way, way back to the origin of the Bay of Pigs under Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon is the one that originally started this movement to invade Cuba using the Cuban exiles and using either Howard Hunt and Bernard Balker and Virgilio Gonzalez and all of these, or Martinez, and all of these people that later end up, James McCord, end up as the Watergate burglars in the Nixon administration.
Two of the people in this caravan with her were also
so
turned up.
Everywhere you look, you see Howard Hunt. In fact, when Arthur Bremer, shot
George
Wallace, the first person ordered to Bremer's apartment was E. Howard Hunt.
Okay. Well, there's another major hypothesis here that part of the theory of some people was that after the Kennedy assassination, it would be blamed on Fidel Castro, that Oswald was a member of this Fair Play for Cuba committee, or at least there were pictures of him associated with this group, plus his connections with the Soviet Union that you outlined in the first program, that he had defected to the Soviet Union, that he'd married the daughter of an intelligence agent, etc. So they were building, therefore, a scenario where they could blame it on Fidel Castro, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and could use that as a pretext for the invasion of Cuba, which would, of course, satisfy both the mob plus these right-wing Cubans and other right-wing groups in the United States. So this is also part of at least a scenario as to what was going on at that time.
I think a very important part of the scenario that was going on. They wanted the patsy. They wanted the finger pointed to Fidel Castro so that there would be an uprising against it.
Let's show the people your conception of the organizational structure of the CIA and the Mafia and the relationships and how this was set up.
In the 1960s, the CIA, using them as sort of the real planning group, had within their group a program they called the ZR Rifle Program. That was the cryptonym for their assassination apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Out of this ZR Rifle Program, the cryptonym for its principal agent was QJ Wynn.
QJ Wynn?
QJ Wynn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, of course, this ZR Rifle Program began to be used with respect to Cuba in 1961. And in doing so, that's when they first became involved in with organized crime. This Sam Giancana, Johnny Roselli, both who died strange and untimely deaths before they could give testimony to a Senate committee. And this organized crime group also were utilizing the Cuban exiles, and also out of this ZR Rifle Program, the man chiefly responsible for it was a man by the name of William Harvey.
He was the coordinator for the, CIA?
For the ZR Rifle Program,
mm-hmm.
through the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And their first project was to kill Fidel Castro. That was,
I don't know that that was their
first
project.
That was a major project.
But that was a major project,
and that would
obviously
involve both these Cuban exiles who would presumably help do it, plus organized crime that had its connections in Cuba as well as its professionals to do something like that.
That's
or was
correct.
This just the umbrella, use that term again, the umbrella organization of the CIA for worldwide assassinations?
Well, it's obviously that,
okay.
Because this was not
right.
just localized to Cuba, but it was mm-hmm. made applicable, according to a document, made applicable to Cuba in 1961,
okay.
which meant that they were going after Fidel Castro. What one of the strange coincidences, and I don't call it a coincidence except in a somewhat of a jocular manner, because I'm up to my eyeballs in coincidences in this case. This QJ Wynn plays an important role in the release on very shortly after the assassination of a man by the name of Tom Davis.
Released? What do you
released from custody of the police over in Algeria.
Oh.
He was arrested in gun running activities. You remember they were having big warfare in and around Algeria in those years. And so he was released with on the behest or with the help of QJ Wynn. What makes this intriguing is that Tom Davis told a well-respected reporter in Dallas that he was using the name of Oswald and in his gun-running activities to the Cuban exiles, that he was connected to the Cuban exiles, but that he was running these guns with a man by the name of Jack Ruby, who was the killer of Lee Harvey Oswald, which, as we now know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Jack Ruby connects to organized crime directly. So you see we've come pretty well full circle with these connections. And Jack Ruby's, before his trial for the murder of Lee Harvey Oswald, his attorney asked him if there was anything he didn't want brought out in this trial. And the one thing that he told his attorney not to get anywhere close to was Tommy Davis.
Let's go into this for a little bit, because this is the hypothesis of the other Oswald. This is the book by Richard Popkin, who's a Kennedy assassination expert. The thesis here is that Oswald alone couldn't have done the assassination because there was more than one rifle. We didn't mention in the first program that the rifle that Oswald used was a quite inferior one. It's unlikely that it could perform such a precision feat of killing the president from the distance in which he was placed in relation to the motorcade. Plus, there's all these other stories about Oswald that would indicate that he is an unlikely candidate for the lone assassin. And in particular, a lot of pictures of him appeared in different places, holding guns, making threats against the president, so that it's possible that someone was masquerading as Oswald to call attention to him, to set him up as a patsy. Mm-hmm. And so now you're saying we have a possibility for the other Oswald, is Tom Davis, all of which would entail a rather large conspiracy, that a lot of individuals were involved in carefully planning this operation, which would require the sort of apparatus that someone like the CIA or organized crime or a very well-financed and well-organized group would have at their disposal.
Would have at their disposal, I think, very definitely.
Okay.
Now, Oswald, or quote Oswald, unquote, was also seen in Mexico City, too.
In a Soviet embassy.
Yeah, in a Soviet embassy. Part of this business to blame it on the commies. Now, did this Davis look like Oswald in actuality?
He had the same build. The only photographs that I have of him, there's no real strong facial resemblance. But he could comb his hair slightly different, color it, and his physical makeup was very much the same. And all we know is that he said that he was using that name and that he was in and around Dallas. And I think probably more importantly, he was traveling across the United States, and he had been with the Cuban exiles. And there was reports from Cuban exiles that, hey, we know Oswald. And yet we had no real reports of Oswald himself having real close contact with the Cuban exiles.
Did any of these other Cuban exiles appear in Dallas, or is there any evidence linking specific members of the Cuban exile community that were involved in this anti-Castro activity to the assassination?
Well, one of the major connections would have to be one that was brought out probably in about 1976, 75, right before I wrote or right after I wrote the major portion of Cover Up, and it was all ready to press. And that was that a Cuban exile who was involved in attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro said that he was called by his case officer, his CIA contact, to meet him in Dallas at a tall building. And when he arrived for that meeting, this CIA case officer was talking with Lee Oswald. And of course, that case officer has never been completely identified, but it's a good possibility that he would be a high ranking member of the CIA who was involved in the planning of the assassination apparatus and knew this Oswald well. Now, whether this was our Lee Oswald, the one who died on November 24th, 1963, or whether it's this other Oswald.
What happened to him?
Tommy Davis, mm-hmm. The second Oswald, as I call him. He was, they found him dead up near Jacksboro, Texas, at an old mining, rock mining place. And allegedly there was no autopsy, so we really don't know mm-hmm. much about it, but he had been dead for many days in hot, humid weather. And he allegedly was stealing copper from this old mine to get some money. That's how far he had gone, and cut through an electrical wire that electrocuted him.
Wow.
But again, we don't.
Many people involved with this that died.
Well, again, it happens at strategic times. It mm-hmm. happened, as the Senate Select Committee had begun to investigate this assassination. Mm-hmm. Of foreign leaders like Fidel Castro. Mm. And he would have been one that would definitely have been called because of his connections to QJ Wynn.
Well, a very curious phenomenon has emerged just this last week or two, and that is that supposedly the CIA was keeping their eye on the Cuban exile community after the Kennedy assassination because they were afraid that something would be revealed in this community that might get out to the press at large. And a report says that a CIA officer, Mr. George Bush, in I think 1963, gave a report to I think J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI concerning this community, which would indicate that the CIA was intensely involved in what the Cubans were up to. And this raises some questions about Mr. George Bush, who is running for President of the United States now, because he had denied previously that he was in the CIA until he was named director of the CIA in 1975. Was this something of a surprise to you?
Very much so.
You're doing your research, and what did you make of this?
I can't make anything out of it right now, except I'm going to look into it more and more. I'm interested in his connection to a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez, who goes back all the way to the Bay of Pigs, you know, which may or may not mean that George Bush goes all the way back to the Bay of Pigs and his involvement with the CIA. Remember, the CIA has employees, and then they have contract agents that are hired for specific tasks and are really not considered on the payroll, but are paid contract amount. And so
they also have
denying
assets,
denying Mr. Bush denying that he was ever involved with the CIA prior to 1975 is a little strong, I think, on his part.
Right. The other thing they have are assets, which are people that work with them on specific projects. An article just appeared in the middle of July in The Nation magazine that indicated that George Bush's biography and the stories about him from various reporters are always very sketchy about what he was doing in the early 1960s. He was working with his oil business there that was very active in the Caribbean, and he was traveling a lot in that area, which would make him a perfect CIA asset. That is, someone who would do activities for them, provide information to them once in a while, and have close working relations with the CIA. The Bush camp has denied, by the way, that he was a member of the CIA at that time, and raised the question, was there another Mr. George Bush? This document, it's an FBI document, the name's George Bush.
Did Tom Davis look like George Bush?
No, afraid not.
But this could be a major embarrassment for Bush, particularly because this Felix Rodriguez that you mentioned turns up in the Iran-Contra operation as the man in El Salvador who was in charge of getting supplies to the Contras. And when the congressional funding of this project was ended for a couple years, Mr. Rodriguez allegedly engaged in some illegal activities to get guns and different supplies to the Contras that might even involve drug running. These are the allegations.
Yeah, they're saying that they're
that are made. And that George Bush's office was in close contact with Felix Rodriguez at this time. Don Gregg, who was Bush's deputy director of the CIA when he was head of it in 1975, and who was one of Bush's closest workers in Bush's office, was in close contact with Felix Rodriguez in this Contra supply operation that would push Bush very close to some highly illegal operations. Now, if he goes all the way back to the 1960s connected with this group, this is sensational.
The only thing that I can say is I'll guarantee it won't lay dormant. There'll be some people working on this between now and election time.
There's another new bit of evidence that has come up since our program in 79, and that concerns a Frenchman by the name of Swetra. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's an intriguing story, and one that we had just started following when I was with you back in the late 1970s. We had gotten hold of a CIA document under the Freedom of Information Act that said that a man by the name of Jean Swetra, a Frenchman, also known as Michael Mertz, also known as Michael Roux, was in Dallas on the day of the assassination and was expelled from the country within 48 hours of the president's death, and that he had previously been involved in attempts on the life of French Premier Charles de Gaulle. So, of course, immediately the antenna goes up on a document like that. Here's an assassin in Dallas, and nobody's looking at him. So we began to pursue him. It's been a long trail, and we're still not through, but I can tell you this, that there is actually a Jean Swetra. Our people has talked to him. He's denied that he was in Dallas, And in fact, he's denied that he's been in the United States, and we have no proof that he has. There is actually a Michael Rue. He was in Texas on the at the time of the assassination. But the man that we became more interested in, because I traced down the immigration and naturalization investigator who was given the responsibility of going and picking up that Frenchman in Dallas on the day of the assassination and seeing that he was expelled from the country. And I questioned him about his, you know, the identification and the appearance, the physical description of the man that he arrested. He said it was a man approximately 45 years old, thinning gray hair, about 200 pounds. Well, John Swetra was 35 years old in 1963 and a full head of hair and probably not over 180 pounds. Michael Rue was only 25 years old. So the only man that met the description was Michael Mertz. And Swetra said, told our people, that Mr. Mertz used his name quite frequently in his travels, because what Mr. Mertz did best, among other things, was smuggle heroin into the United States. He was a killer and known as one all the way back to the time of World War II. He became a member of the French Secret Service, and that's the equivalent of our CIA, STEC. Mm-hmm. And in his connections with that organization, began a drug operation into this country. Became very, very wealthy. Not only did he do that, he married the daughter of the biggest brothel owner in Paris, France.
Now, the CIA, or the OSS at the time, was very instrumental in bringing the French mafia back and busting heads to keep the communist unions from and the Communist Party from gaining power in France, and they helped particularly in Marseille to help reestablish the mafia and their drug operations. Now, is this where this fellow was connected?
This fellow here is connected with that same group in Marseille.
And how does he connect with that structure that you outlined that might well have been the group that carried out the Kennedy assassination? Where does he fit into this scenario?
That's what I would like to know. We've not been able to contact him. He's highly protected. Mm-hmm. Lives on a huge piece of property outside of Paris. He is very, very wealthy and very well protected. You can't get to him. So I'd like to ask him, were you in Dallas? You know, he probably, if I were guessing, and because of his background, he was, by the way, involved in infiltrating the OSS. I mean, the OAS, the secret army organization that was trying to kill President de Gaulle.
Right.
His modus operandi to infiltrate the OAS was the same one that Oswald used in New Orleans to infiltrate the pro-Castro.
Oh, or make him think that he was pro-OAS.
Right, he passed out leaflets.
Right.
So he, in my opinion, is a good suspect for the director of the assassination, and could possibly be Q.J. Wynne, who was a European.
He could have. That's an interesting hypothesis. He could have also simply allied himself with the American mafia to help finance the operation that would involve a lot of money, and perhaps to provide personnel for the operation. It might be the French and American mafia got together and had these intelligence agency contacts that they'd worked with, and that was the core organization. This could easily be a piece of the puzzle.
Right. But we do know that he was considered the protege of a man by the name of Lucien Rivard, who was a French-Canadian out of the Montreal area, who also was in and out of Cuba with Santos Trafficante. And so the Cuban connection comes in.
So he has the Cuban motive as
right,
well.
As well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Now, we've had first the Warren Commission, then we had this most recent congressional investigation. And we still are involved in trying to find out what happened. Is it just so complex that it's just impossible to get a handle on, or could it be solved very easily, you think?
I don't think it's so complex. I think it's just been so mismanaged. It's
the investigation.
A political assassination should never be investigated by political people or in the political arena, in my opinion. If you want to find out who committed the murder, you get investigators and people who are familiar with how to investigate a murder, and you pay them and you go after it. It's my contention that this case is solvable and could be done within probably 6 months' time.
And how would this happen? What would be necessary to carry the investigation to stage further?
I think that, number one, it ought to be done in Texas. It ought to be done in Dallas, Texas. We ought to convene a grand jury. We now have a new district attorney in Dallas who was not present at the time of the assassination, and show them the evidence. Let them call the people, the witnesses, subpoena the evidence, hire the necessary consultants, I'm not patting myself or any other critic on the back when I say this, but we've spent 25 years looking at this. We know where the evidence is. We know the places to look. And if there was a mistake that the House Select Committee made, it was not taking advantage of those 20 years or so of research and experience.
Did they call any of the people who...
Only at a very, small, and opportune times. And it was never a give and take. They never took us into confidence where they, if they could tell us something, then we could tell them something. It was never a two-way street. And so they lost a great deal. Even though we kept on assisting them right up to the end with the questions they would ask, we'd give them the best answers. But had they been able to say, well, such and such happened, and this says this, we probably could have taken it a step further.
Have you been able to get any assistance or cooperation with any government agencies or individuals within them, or do you have to wait until these people retire?
I think, we've not gotten any. Probably the most helpful has been the FBI in the last few years.
Well, that's a change.
In the release of documents.
Freedom of Information
Freedom
Act.
Freedom of Information Act.
They've been forced to do it.
Well, they're not as much forced to do it now as they really do seem to go out of the way to cooperate.
That's a change.
Yeah, it is a big change. The CIA is still a closed door. And they won't respond to most anything. And I think, basically what must happen is that it has to come from the people again, and the pressure has to be put on the people in places of responsibility. That can only come by education.
And the media, too, has a responsibility. Obviously, as we indicated in the first show, the media was part of the cover-up, and it's the media that would focus attention on this to make it a worthwhile issue in terms of putting importance on it.
Right. You talked about in the first segment of this show about our Assassination Archives and Research Center, and thrust.
This is the Assassination Archive and Research Center in Washington, D.C., right, that you're a founder and a board of director on.
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And our thrust is going to be not only the gathering of information and the gathering of files and the filing of information, lawsuits when necessary, but also to see that this is brought to the attention of the American public. It would be great if our group, which is recognized academically as a historical group now, could have primetime television coverage, and let us just go on the air for a mini-series, if you want to call it, because as you can see by our time together, you can't do it in an hour or 2 hours.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And show the American people the evidence of the conspiracy, of the cover-up, of the potential suspects or the guilty party, and force not necessarily a new investigation, a grand jury, looking into it, looking at the facts, and then bringing to trial those that they feel need to be indicted.
So you want to go more through the legal system. You've seen two political investigations.
Correct.
That were cover-ups.
Correct.
So you no longer think that the federal government has any interest or motivation.
It's not no longer. I predicted it before. I said when the congressional committee was organized that it should never be in a...
Right. So we shouldn't make this a demand for the Duke if we want to vote for him.
That's right.
Because they would just cover it up anyway, even if they did another investigation. But you think if we got some legal prosecutions going, that this might unearth the evidence, and if the media took this up and the American people became educated as to what happened, this could finally solve the case.
I think it could. I think that we have open-minded, young, vigorous attorneys now with sharp minds, and would have an open mind to it. I'm 50 years old, spent 25 years. We can furnish them with the facts, and they're not politically married yet, and I think they can do something.
Now, your book, Cover Up, you had to publish that yourself, I understand, because you couldn't find a publisher that would take it, and so there was a kind of limited edition, about 3,000,
right,
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way anybody can find a copy of that anymore?
Every time we play
your program, people call, say, I want to buy Cover Up, and can't find it.
Unfortunately, it's out of print and cannot be found except occasionally in a used bookstore or collector bookstores. They're selling in collector bookstores now for $35. Hopefully, that before too long, I'm going to update it. It's 10 years old now, or more, 12 years old. Update it and hopefully find a publisher this time. It's a different mentality now than it was even in 1976, and certainly different from the one in 63. So there's a lot of new evidence and a lot of directions that we can point now, and I'd like to see it in print.
And that brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. Very glad you could join us. If you'd like to contact Gary Shaw, his address is P.O. Box 722, Cleburne, Texas, 76031. That's P.O. Box 722, Cleburne, Texas, 76031. The organization which Gary Shaw is co-founder and member is Assassination Archives and Research Center in Washington, D.C. The address is 918 F Street, Northwest, Suite 510, and the zip code is 20004. Their phone number is area code 202-393-1917. The Assassination Archives and Research Center is set up to be a repository of all sorts of materials concerning all assassinations. They have thousands of books, articles, manuscripts, photos, files, tapes. They have a computerized index of 15,000 names and events, and FBI and CIA documents. A wonderful organization. We'd like to thank our crew for the program, our director, Brian Lynch, camera people, Joanna Mihalik and Beverly Garrett. Our audio person was Robert Rober.